100-year-old can of beans, a three-cornered hat with a feather in it, old green and brown bottles that shimmered in the sunlight, lead soldiers, a child's printing press, a rocking horse, stacks of newspapers, wagon wheels, Victrolas and other old phonographs, brass beds and stuffed animals, a fox, a badger, a bobcat, helmets from World War II, and one, and a gas mask. Ida told me I could pick out anything I wanted for Hanukkah. She said I could have 7 small presents and 1 big one. She'd pick out the small ones, but I could pick out anything I wanted in the store as my big present. Then we'll forget you picked it out. Why should I forget about it? I asked. Because then it will be a surprise, and all good things are surprises. That made sense, but just to make sure, I asked her, I can have anything? Of course, I wanted something really big, so I looked around for the biggest things I could find. Maybe the Victrola. That was big, but not big enough. The biggest things in the store were giant china cabinets and sideboards, but those were boring, grown-up things. The thing I really wanted was the can of 100-year-old beans, but that was too small. Then I noticed something I'd never seen before hanging on the wall in back of the store. I'd been in the store a dozen times. It must have just been put up because it was not the type of thing you'd forget about. It was the biggest flag I'd ever seen. It took up half the wall, and it was so colorful, so big, so bold-looking, I knew I had to have it. Of course, I'd want to hang it in the room I shared with my brother, but I was a little concerned that once my parents saw it, they'd want to hang it in the living room or at the bottom of the stairs. No, it's my flag, I'd tell them. Ida gave it to me for Hanukkah. The flag had a red background and a white circle in the middle. In the circle were 2 bold black lines intersected like a crooked pinwheel. I loved pinwheels. I took Ida by the hand. I know what I want, I said, but you have to close your eyes. She did as I said, and I led her a few steps so that she faced the wall with the flag. Now open them, I said. She opened her eyes. Only one could see, and the other looked uncertainly in front of her. What? She said. I don't see anything. There, I said. That flag. What flag? I don't see. And then she saw it, and she put her hand on her heart, the way she did when I woke her for midnight snacks. Ida said nothing. She grabbed my hand and dragged me out of the store. No, never, she said. Never, never, never. And don't ask any more or you get nothing.
But Ida, I said, it'll be a surprise. I'll forget about it if you buy it for me. You promised I could have anything.
Nothing, she screamed at me. You'll get nothing for Hanukkah.
Her screaming at me was stranger than having no presents, and I cried against her side while she stroked my head silently as we waited a half hour in the parking lot for my parents to pick us up again. She wouldn't even speak of the flag, and I never mentioned it again either. But not that long afterward, I saw that flag again in a book, one of the books Ida gave me for Hanukkah that year. In the book, the flag looked small and not so grand, and over the years, as I read more, I started to understand why some things must be denied and why all surprises are not so good.
Murray Horowitz read All Good Things Are Surprises, written by Robin Hemley. Hemley is the author of 7 books of fiction and nonfiction, including Nola, a memoir of faith, art, and madness, Do-Over, Reply All, Stories, and Turning Life into Fiction. His stories and essays have appeared in the New York Times, New York Times Magazine, the Chicago Tribune, and many other literary magazines and anthologies. He is the editor of Defunct Magazine.
Potatoes by Tova Mervis. The only potato left in the bin was lumpy, pale, and misshapen, not unlike the faces of Bella's 2 sisters-in-law. Her husband Sam had invited them, their husbands, and their children for dinner that night, the first night of Hanukkah,
without telling her.
How could you? Bella asked him in Yiddish.
I thought you knew, Sam said. We do it every year.
Every year, she said, making no attempt to hide the bitterness in her voice. Bella was originally from Grodno, and this was her first Hanukkah in Memphis, Tennessee, where every day was still shrouded in unfamiliarity. She had been in this city for 4 months, living at the edge of the Pinch, the Jewish neighborhood where all immigrants began. She and Sam had been married for 2 years before he and his brothers left for America with promises that they would send for her as soon as they could. As the time she and Sam spent apart grew larger, so did her expectations, increasing further with each letter that brought news of his success. Together, Sam and his brothers were operating a printing press. He'd found a small apartment. His brothers had married girls from this new city whose name she could barely pronounce, along a river even less pronounceable. She took Sam's letters with her everywhere, showing them off to neighbors who asked after her husband, filling their ears with news of his good fortune. She told stories set in Memphis to her younger brother, who both awaited and feared the day Sam would send for her. At night, she curled up with the letters, as she would with a husband, and dreamt that she was already there. It had taken 4 years, far longer than either she or Sam had imagined when they said goodbye. Having been away from each other longer than they'd been married, their anniversary had entered into the realm of negative numbers. Any more months, and they would revert to being strangers. When Bella arrived, she and Sam were unsure how to act with one another. Sam's English, which he used all the time now, sounded nearly perfect to her unschooled ears, and the only time he seemed the same man she had married was when he spoke to her in Yiddish. She had come knowing no English at all, and even after these months here, she still knew none. If she begrudgingly tried out a word Sam taught her, she felt like a cripple, with no way to make her tongue move as she wanted. Despite Sam's reassurances that it was only a matter of time before she picked up the language, she had stopped trying, refusing to take classes at the neighborhood house or go any place where she couldn't speak Yiddish.
Sam coaxed her. He cajoled her. He said that he hardly recognized her as the same spirited, self-assured young woman he had married. But Bella wouldn't budge from her steadfast position that she would never feel at home here. On any other night, the news of her sisters-in-law's imminent arrival would have sparked a screaming match, which at least would have been in Yiddish. But on the eve of the first night of Hanukkah, neither Sam nor Bella wanted to fight. And seeing her distress, Sam tried to reassure her. "They'll bring food," he said as Bella snatched her hand from his reach. "They always do." And he tried to hug her, his arms closing stiffly around her even stiffer body. They always did, it was true. Her sisters-in-law, Mira and Rosalie, who were American-born, would arrive laden with food and judgment. They were both large and loud, talking rapidly to each other in English. Sometimes Bella caught a word that sounded familiar, but mostly she sat beside them in awkward silence, trying to ward off the inevitable headache she got from having to listen to lives conducted so noisily in a language she couldn't understand. Whenever they came over with their small packs of children, her small apartment grew even smaller. She felt like an outsider in her own living room. Without children of her own, Bella felt unbearably alone. Her emptiness was so great that were she turned upside down and shaken, nothing would come out.
Wriggling out of Sam's embrace, Bella grabbed her pocketbook and ran from the apartment toward Market Square, hoping one of the nearby stores would still be open. She was determined to return home with enough potatoes to make latkes. Mira and Rosalie might have their children, their nice clothes, their endless stream of things to talk about, but at the very least, she would have something to serve at her own table.
It was the first time Bella had been out alone at night. Until now, she'd ventured out only during the day, on small journeys in the neighborhood. On Sundays, Sam wanted her to ride the streetcar with him and see the rest of the city to which he was enthralled. When he was at work, he encouraged her to call Mira or Rosalie and let them serve as tour guide. But Bella refused, preferring to remain in their neighborhood where she felt comfortable. In the pinch, many of the storefront signs were in Yiddish, as were the menus in Rosen's Delicatessen and the three kosher butcher shops where men who looked like her father waited on her from behind the counters. The streets of the pinch were crowded with people speaking Yiddish. Irish and Italian immigrants lived here as well, but she felt comfortable with them because their eyes revealed the same fear she felt, and she wondered if, in their dreams too, they still lived in the countries they'd left behind. With their eyes closed, could they recreate entire villages and towns? At night, did the streets, the houses, the marketplaces come to life inside their heads?
But it wasn't enough to feel at home only in her night's dreams. Sometimes Bella tried to inhabit Grudnow during the day as well. When she caught a glimpse of the Mississippi, she assured herself it was really the Bovar or the Niemen, two of the rivers that ran through Grudnow. When she saw a pack of teenage boys jostling, laughing, and talking, she told herself that her brother was among them. Soon, her mind began playing these tricks on her all the time. She mistook strangers for the people she used to know, sure that the woman making sandwiches behind the counter at Rosen's was actually the nosy neighbor who had lived next door to her aunt, or that the man selling newspapers on Market Street was the tailor from back home.
Tonight, none of the stores in the pinch was open. No one lingered on corners or in doorsteps. Most of the shopkeepers and their customers had gone home to celebrate the holiday, and already she could see the first twinkling lights in their windows. Bella considered giving up and returning home, but pride held her back. Thinking of Mira and Rosalie, who were certainly at her house by now, expecting to smell latkes and ready to whisper about her if they didn't, she kept going. Past the closed stores, past Market Street Square, past any vestige of familiarity. Having traversed the boundaries of the pinch, she came to a church, a cemetery, and a courthouse. Some of the houses she passed were so large, they made her mouth drop open in envy and awe. She tried to keep track of where she'd turned and in what direction she'd gone, but soon she'd walked too far to have any idea where she was. She couldn't turn back, because she didn't know which way back was, so she had no choice but to continue. She worried that she might never find her way back. She'd gone so far that she would reach the edge of the city and end up irretrievably lost in this country to which she had no connection. The fear which had been bottled inside her since her arrival in Memphis came spilling out, and thinking that she heard footsteps behind her, Bella started to run. The hard leather of her boots dug into her ankles, and her long auburn hair came loose from its bun. She'd never run this fast. She hadn't known she had it in her to run like this, and amazed at the power of her legs, she wondered if she might run so fast and so far that her feet would leave the ground, her skirt would fill with air, her hair would fly out behind her, she would cross first a river, then an ocean, she would land in a field bursting with more potatoes than she'd ever seen, more than she and her brother had been able to imagine. She'd gather potatoes by the dozens, and if she kept going down this dark, nameless street, she'd carry them home, not to Sam, but to her parents' small house, where she'd find her brother clasping the letters she'd written him, awaiting her return.
Up ahead, Bella saw a light, and not knowing in what city or in what world she was, she ran toward it, remembering what night it was and thinking that perhaps these were the lights of the menorah, maybe those of her parents and her brothers and her aunts and cousins and everyone she'd known in Grudnow. But as she got closer, she saw that the light was coming from a small store that was still open. Inside, she made out the figure of the shopkeeper wiping off a counter. And panting, nearly dazed with exhaustion, Bella pressed her face against the glass, wondering if she knew him as well. But if she did, she'd been away too long to remember who he was. She knocked anxiously on the door. Maybe he would recognize her and let her inside. Startled by the sound, the shopkeeper looked up, then shook his head apologetically to let her know that the store was closed. But having come this far, Bella wasn't going to be put off. She knocked harder, and finally he came over and opened the door a crack. "Kartoffel?" Bella asked, using the Yiddish word for potato.
He looked blankly at her, and thinking that maybe she had spoken too quietly, she repeated her request.
"Kartoffel, kartoffel, kartoffel,"
her voice growing louder and more insistent with each repetition. In the air, she drew the shape of a potato, but he understood nothing from her wild gestures. Peering in from a back room, two little girls were watching this exchange, both of them clapping their hands over their mouths to stifle their laughter. The shopkeeper, too, tried to hide a smile, and Bella's face burned with shame. He, like everyone here, was nothing more than a stranger. Like everything she had once imagined she would find in Memphis, the semblance of familiarity had been a mirage. She was foolish to have come out alone and ventured this far. She was even more foolish to think that she would ever return to Grudnow. The shopkeeper's amusement soon gave way to exasperation, and he shrugged his shoulders and started to close the door. But desperate to make herself understood, Bella's mind spun wildly, and from somewhere inside the thicket in her head, where she knew more than she had allowed herself to believe, she pulled out an English word.
Potato, she said tentatively.
Her pronunciation was mangled, her accent was thick, but the word was right.
Potato, Bella said again, this time more clearly, more definitively. Potato.
The shopkeeper's face opened up in comprehension and kindness, and he stepped back and allowed her inside. He directed her to the bins that held the day's remaining vegetables. Most of what was left had been picked over, but from among the nearly rotted and the scrawny, she counted out 7 fine, round potatoes. With the 1 potato she had at home, she'd have 8, enough to make latkes for everyone.
She carried them to the counter and slowly counted out her money. Holding onto the grocery bag and to this first word of English, which she'd claimed as her own, Bella no longer felt so lost. She experienced the first true stirrings of familiarity, a feeling which she hoped would last for all 8 days of the holiday and beyond.
Potatoes by Tova Mervis, read by Susan Stamberg and Murray Horowitz. Mervis was born and raised in Memphis, the setting for her national best-selling first novel, The Ladies' Auxiliary. Her second novel, The Outside World, follows the lives of 2 Jewish families.
Gifts of the Jewish Magi, with apologies to O. Henry, by Allegra Goodman. $18.70. That was all. Bill picked up the pearl stud earrings in their blue velvet box.
Are they real pearls? He asked the sidewalk vendor at the Park Street station.
Everything's real, the salesman assured him. Real pearls, real gold. You need a watch? These are real Rolexes. Date just, lady date just, gold, platinum, titanium.
I should get home, Bill said. I'm late already. That evening was the first night of Hanukkah. He couldn't help feeling pleased with himself as he ran down the stairs to the trains. The earrings were not only a bargain, but elegant. A classic gift for Perry. And she hadn't asked for anything except that he get his hair cut and his beard trimmed. Bill still wore his hair in a ponytail. He was pushing 60, and his beard and long hair lent him a scholarly appearance. He looked a bit like an early American, or perhaps a grizzled sailor on shore leave from Old Ironsides. In fact, he was a scholar, and a bit of a seaman as well. He was a specialist in sleep disorders at MIT, and he had a small sailboat of his own named Peregrine, after his graceful, sensible, patient wife. This wife of his had just got home. She stamped the slush off her boots in the vestibule of the Cambridge triple-decker where she and Bill lived. Perry and Bill were relative newlyweds, married for just 2 years, but they'd lived together in the apartment for 16. Their names had faded next to the ancient buzzer downstairs, and the label on their mailbox was covered with peeling yellow tape. Years ago, Bill had bought their third-floor apartment for $44,000, an almost unimaginable sum in his mind. He had walked in, he'd told Perry, and fallen instantly in love with the dark Victorian woodwork, the comforting decrepitude of the apartment, the worn linoleum floor in the kitchen, the giant elm out front, the seedy neighborhood. Now the elm had passed away, or, more accurately, been chopped and hacked to pieces, a victim of Dutch elm disease. The neighborhood was full of families, and architects, and journalists, and shrinks, and Bill was awed and almost penitent to think that the apartment was now worth 10 times what he had paid for it.
He hated to think he owned something so valuable. He was funny that way. He wore a ragged down parka, the sleeves patched up with silver duct tape. Perry had resigned herself to the fact years ago that, with the notable exceptions of his apartment and his boat, Bill's only voluntary purchases were used books. She took the menorah off one of Bill's sagging bookcases and gave it a good dusting before she set it on the table by the front window. Then she picked out candles, yellow and blue from the cardboard Hanukkah candle box. The candles were small as crayons, and she knew if she lit them now, they'd melt away to nothing long before Bill got home. So she stretched out on the couch and waited. Perry had converted to Judaism 3 years before. Formerly, she'd been a non-practicing Episcopalian, a doctoral candidate in European history, and a dance therapist. Now she taught the art of the memoir at the Cambridge Center for Adult Education. She loved the Jewish religion, the history, the high holidays, the fasting for Yom Kippur while autumn leaves fell down, the idea of a season of introspection. Passover seemed a brilliant holiday to her, part Thanksgiving feast, part graduate seminar. However, Hanukkah always left her feeling a little empty. She knew it was only a minor Jewish holiday. Still, she wished there was more to Hanukkah, more feasting, more ceremonies, more falderal. The neighbors were bustling, stringing Christmas lights from their front porches, adorning their front doors with wreaths. At night, when she drove through Somerville, the houses blazed with illuminated reindeer and nativity scenes. The three wise men, giant plastic magi, arrayed themselves in robes and crowns and turbans before the plastic baby Jesus to do homage and deliver their caskets of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Outdoor creches were not Perry's style. Still, she missed caroling. Giving up Christian theology had not been hard for her, but she did love the music. And she missed decorating a tree. This above all, she missed the Christmas tree, the magic sparkling spruce rising to the ceiling, spreading its branches and sprinkling all the gifts below with pine needles. She couldn't help it. She missed that symbol of her childhood. The year before, she'd actually bought some blue and silver tinsel for the mantelpiece and a shiny banner cut out in the shape of multicolored dreidels. "You can't be serious," Bill said. And she'd assured him she was not, and stuffed the tinsel back into the bag. She realized Bill enjoyed understated holidays. "Look at it this way," Bill always said. "The great thing about Hanukkah is you don't have to pretend to be merry." He surprised her then with his jubilance as he stepped in the door. "Happy Hanukkah!" he cried out. She thought he must be joshing her with exaggerated cheer. "Happy Hanukkah to you," she said. "I got you something," he told her. "Oh, your haircut much better," she said, examining him. "No, I got you an actual gift," he told her. "Really?" "Yeah, do you want to see it?" "Hold on, I got you something too," she said. And she went to the coat closet and took out a new down parka, exactly like his old ripped one. "See," she said, "it's the same size, the same color. I had to back order it." "My old one is perfectly good," Bill said. But she kissed him and explained, "I'm not allowing you out of the house any longer with duct tape on your sleeves." "It's reflective," he pointed out. "The tape is actually safer at night." "I don't care," she said. "Oh, all right, all right. Thank you. Can I give you mine?" He fished in his pocket for a moment. Then he held out a real jewelry box, velvet covered in midnight blue. She opened the box and found nothing tacky, nothing jokey, but a simple pair of earrings she might actually wear. "They're real," he said. "I see that," she told him, amazed. She and Bill hadn't bothered with an engagement ring or even wedding bands. He had never given her jewelry before. "Put them on," he urged her with childish delight. "See, they'll go with everything." And she had not realized until that moment how good it felt to receive a gift from him. How much brighter the minor holiday of Hanukkah became. She was nearly blissful until she took possession of Bill's disreputable old coat so that she could burn it. "Wait, at least let me empty out my pockets," he protested. "I'll do it," she said, and shook out his gloves along with five more velvet-covered jewelry boxes. "Bill," she said, "what is this?"
"Nothing," he told her. "Just give me those."
But it was too late. She opened one box and then the next,
five handsome boxes containing five pairs of pearl stud earrings identical to the pair he'd just given her. "What are these for, Bill?" He looked at her, uncertain, sheepish. "For you," he said. "All these earrings for me? You got me six pairs of earrings? How many ears do you think I have?" "Well, I wasn't going to give them to you all at once," he said. She stared at him in amazement. "You were going to hold them in reserve, huh?" "Well, I figured they would be nice for anniversaries and birthdays, and they were a terrific deal." "Billy," she didn't know whether to laugh or to cry, "that is not how you give presents. You never buy six pairs of anything unless it's socks, all right? And you never, ever say they were a terrific deal." "I'm sorry," he said, throwing up his hands. "My parents were Trotskyites. You know that." "You can't use that excuse every single time." "I'm telling you they were communists," he said. "We didn't give gifts in our family. We hated the whole idea of gifts, not to mention Jewish holidays. We were supposed to feel guilty we had food on the table and shirts on our backs. I wasn't brought up with all this," he pointed to the menorah.
"I wasn't either, but at least I try," she reproached him.
"Well, I just need a little more practice," he said, looking at the open jewelry boxes. "I suppose I could find the guy and try to bring them back." Then Perry decided to laugh. They lit the candles and snuggled on the couch, and Bill gave Perry a foot massage, and they debated going out to dinner at the vegan restaurant in Porter Square. The two of them were, strictly speaking, a little self-absorbed. They were each other's children. But Bill and Perry were wise in their way as well. There was empathy and humor in their devotion. They gave of themselves. Indeed, they tried to transform themselves for each other, and these were great gifts. These were treasures worthy of Jewish magi.
That was Murray Horowitz reading Gifts of the Jewish Magi by novelist Allegra Goodman. She has written many novels, including Catterskill Falls, Paradise Park, Intuition, and The Other Side of the Island. Her short story collections include The Family Markowitz and Total Immersion. Allegra Goodman's works have also appeared in The New Yorker, Commentary, and Slate. More stories up next. I'm Korva Coleman, and you're listening to Hanukkah Lights from NPR.
Join us Sunday night for a special evening concert of holiday music. It starts at 7 with Advent Voices. Lynn Warfel hosts an hour of contemplative music for the season. At 8, it's a choral Christmas with Stille Antico. The award-winning group sings sacred music by Talis, Bird, and others. That's a special evening concert, Advent Voices, and a choral Christmas with Stille Antico, Sunday night at 7 on WILL-FM.
The Two Menorahs by Daniel Mark Epstein.
The joke on Lombard Street was that Shechtel Ben Meirink was so old that even God had forgotten his birth date. The only man older than Shechtel was Moshe Weiss, who once could remember the birth of Shechtel Ben Meirink, but now was so old that he had forgotten he ever remembered it. The two men lived across the hall from each other in apartments upstairs from the butcher. Shechtel Ben Meirink had a long beard. So did Moshe Weiss, but Moshe's beard was silvery white, while Shechtel's beard was tinged with yellow no matter how much he scrubbed it. Now, these old men loved to argue. They argued over baseball and politics, but most of all they loved to argue over the Torah and Halacha and how a man should live. On the first day of Hanukkah, Shechtel Ben Meirink climbed the stairs with a load of groceries. When he got to the hallway, he was huffing and puffing and a little dizzy, so he set down his groceries to catch his breath. Something did not look right. On the table next to his door stood the Hanukkah lamp, right where it belonged, but across the hall next to Moshe Weiss's door, there was no menorah. The table was bare. Shechtel stroked his beard. He could feel an argument coming on. He could feel it like dry heat from the soles of his feet to the fringe of hair around his ears. It was the argument he had won last year about the Hanukkah lamps.
Schefftel said the menorah was supposed to be lighted in the hall outside the door so it could be seen by people coming and going. Moshe Weiss said this was dangerous. A dog might bump the table or a child play with the candles and set the house afire. He wanted the menorah inside where he could keep an eye on it. Both men quoted the Holy Scriptures. But that had been a year ago, and Schefftel thought the matter was settled. He knocked on Moshe Weiss's door. The door opened.
So no, Moshe?
He began.
What you got in the bag?
Said Moshe Weiss.
I got a chicken, I got a few potatoes, and I got fresh flour to make Hanukkah pancakes. But enough of the small talk. I couldn't help but notice that here it is Hanukkah and almost sundown, and on the table next to your door is no menorah. So where's the menorah? Come in, Schefftel ben Meiring,
said Moshe, smiling.
And you'll see the menorah in all its glory here on the table where it belongs.
But Moshe,
said Schefftel, stepping inside,
this is not where the lamp belongs. Remember the halacha? It is the religious duty of a Jew to let the Hanukkah lamp shine outside his door for all to see.
Except,
said Moshe Weiss.
Excepting what?
Schefftel asked.
Except in the days of persecution. It is written that if the lamp attracts scoffers to the house, it should be set inside the door, and in the days of persecution, on the table.
Moshe,
said Schefftel gently.
These are not the days of persecution. We are living in America in 1955, and a Jew can come and go as he pleases.
But what about my nieces in Kiev and your nephews in Moscow? As long as Jews are in bondage, I call these the days of persecution. And my Hanukkah lamp goes on the table inside the house.
By now, Moshe Weiss was shining with righteous fury. His pink cheeks glowed above his silver-white beard. As his neighbor prepared to leave, Moshe asked,
So what do you say to that, Schefftel?
And Schefftel replied,
I say that when you get like this, there is no arguing with you. But if I was to argue, I would say that in the halacha, where it says days of persecution really means days and lands of persecution, and here in America, it is our duty to let the Hanukkah light shine outside for all to see.
So now,
said Moshe Weiss,
you're going to rewrite the law to make it say what you want?
Any fool can see what the passage means.
So, now I'm a fool?
You're the same man you were before,
Schefftel replied.
Well, you,
Moshe Weiss sputtered.
You,
speak up, Moshe. Your beard is yellow. You must have dripped schmaltz on it.
Schefftel ben Meiring stroked his yellow beard. He picked up his groceries and walked across the hall and put his key in the lock.
Good yontif, Schefftel,
said Moshe, smiling.
Good yontif, Moshe,
said Schefftel ben Meiring. Moshe Weiss went back into his apartment and picked up his menorah by the stem. He carried it into the hall and set it up outside his door. He filled all 8 branches of the menorah with candles, and while singing the barucha, he began lighting the 8 candles with the shamas. Across the hall, the door opened. Schefftel came out, holding 2 candles and a stove match. He nodded appreciatively when he saw that his neighbor had set up the menorah in the hall. Then his face darkened.
Moshe,
he called, but Moshe was singing too loud to hear anything.
Moshe.
When the barucha was done, Moshe Weiss turned around. Schefftel said,
It is good that you have seen the error of your ways, but what's with the 8 candles? Are you lost in time? This is the first night and not the last.
School of Shammai,
said Moshe Weiss proudly.
Shammai says 8 candles the first night, 7 the second, 6 the third.
Oi,
cried Schefftel.
Again with the school of Shammai. Nobody has lit 8 candles the first night for 1,000 years.
They were all wrong,
shouted Moshe Weiss, and his cheeks shone. Schefftel ben Meiring lit his 2 candles and sang the barucha. Moshe sang along. Then the men stood for a while in the glow of their Hanukkah lamps. Schefftel invited Moshe to come and smell the chicken cooking while they discussed Shammai and Hillel and the lighting of the candles. Now, this was a very old argument, and they knew it well. Rabbi Shammai would light 8 candles the first night and 7 the second, because this clearly represents the burning of the oil, which must have diminished even though it outlasted the Maccabees' expectations. Rabbi Hillel, who was more poetic, started with 1 candle and ended with the blaze of 8. This is more dramatic and builds on our feeling of wonder at the miracle. As Schefftel cooked in the kitchen, the men played through the ancient argument like musicians sight-reading an old score. Though they both knew all the twists and turns, they still got very excited. And when they had eaten the whole chicken and drunk a glass each of wine, Schefftel felt the blood rising in his head.
"Now, Moshe,"
he said,
"after all is said and done, suppose a stranger comes up the stairs. He looks down our hall, and he sees the 2 menorahs. One is burning 9 candles, and the other is burning 2. Now, what do you suppose he thinks of us?"
"Well, if he has read Rabbi Shammai..."
"He hasn't read Rabbi Shammai."
"How do you know, Schefftel? You just said he's a stranger."
"He hasn't read Shammai, and he looks at the 2 menorahs and he says, 'Ha! These Jews cannot even agree on how many lights to burn on the first night of Hanukkah. And Moshe Weiss,'
he said solemnly,
'this is not good for the Jews.'"
Now, this was a sentence neither man ever wished to hear. It struck terror in their hearts, and suddenly they didn't want to argue anymore. Moshe, flushed with wine and the spirit of harmony, agreed to light the candles like Hillel this year. But Schefftel would not hear of it. He swore that the school of Shammai was a great tradition, and Moshe agreed. The two men retired to big armchairs in the living room. They sat for a while in an unfamiliar silence.
"So no,"
said Moshe.
"So no,"
replied Schefftel. As the men had tacitly agreed not to argue any more, the clock ticked loudly on the mantelpiece, and the minutes dragged by. They felt awkward and lonely in the peaceful silence, as if a lively companion had deserted them. Then Moshe noticed that his friend was looking at him strangely.
"Schefftel?"
he said. But Schefftel did not answer. He just stared.
"Schefftel!"
he called. And when he got no answer but the blank stare, Moshe got up and crossed the room. He put his face up to Schefftel's face. The man appeared to have fallen asleep with his eyes wide open.
"Wake up, Schefftel,"
he said, putting a hand on his friend's shoulder. But the old man was rigid in his silence, and he did not even seem to be breathing. Now Moshe got very frightened and did not know what to do. Was Schefftel in a trance? Moshe called his name, grabbed his shoulders, gave him a good shake. Was this one of those quiet heart attacks? He slapped Schefftel on the cheeks. Still nothing. He wanted to call for help, but the nearest phone was on the corner, and he did not want to leave his friend alone for a minute. Suddenly, he had an idea. Pulling a chair up next to Schefftel, he began to argue with him. He started off arguing about death, arguing with Schefftel it was a stupid idea to die on the first night of Hanukkah with 7 nights of feasting left to go. Tomorrow night, he, Moshe, would make beef brisket.
"So, Schefftel, what do you say to that? What?"
When he got no answer, Moshe resumed the argument about the Hanukkah lights, saying he never really liked the school of Shammai. It starts out with a big bang, but by the time you get to the last night, the 1 candle burning alone looks kind of sad and forlorn.
"Besides,"
he argued,
"Hillel knew that Hanukkah celebrates the inspiration of our people. Each candle stands for a human soul. Where there is only 1 light, it feels overwhelmed by darkness. But soon comes another light, and another, and the darkness must give way. Wake up, Schefftel. The family of Jews is great and strong. Though our enemies reduce our numbers, as long as there is 1 candle burning, it will lead to another and another until our lamp lights up the whole world. Now, Schefftel, what do you think of that, you in the school of Shammai?"
Then, as if nothing unusual had occurred, Schefftel Ben Meirink stroked his beard.
I think,
said Schefter Ben Meyrink,
you have drunk too much red wine. You are smitten with the poetry of Rabbi Hillel, and you have forgotten the solid virtues and common sense of Rabbi Shammai. Schefter!
Cried Moshe Weiss.
I thought you were dead! Because I defended Shammai,
said Schefter, blinking.
Schefter,
said his friend, overjoyed.
Look at the clock. You see how much time has passed?
Yes,
said Schefter Ben Meyrink, sighing heavily.
So it is with life. The time always flies when you're having a good argument.
Susan Stamberg and Murray Horwitz read The Two Menorahs by Daniel Mark Epstein. Epstein is a poet and biographer whose subjects include Edna St. Vincent Millay, Nat King Cole, and Bob Dylan. His work, The Lincolns, Portrait of a Marriage, was named one of the top 10 books of 2008 by the Wall Street Journal and the Chicago Sun-Times.
My Hanukkah Gift by Farida Golden. Her eyes, blue-green like the waters of the Caspian Sea, looked the same even though the wrinkles around them testified to our long separation, 30 years. Later, Shoreh would tell me that she recognized me from my eyes as well. Iranian eyes, she said, the color of southern dates, deep brown with speckles of gold. Her hair was still blonde, even if now from a bottle, her skin even lighter next to mine. She ran her hand through my gray hair, nature's highlights, I told her. She had plans for them. I knew her well. She noticed the extra weight at my waist only after she wrapped her arms around me. She winked at me. We kissed on both cheeks, awakening memories of two teenage girls giggling in the back of the classroom, dodging the chalk that our stern teacher threw at us. We had much to catch up with. What had happened to our friends, to our city, to us? We had written to each other faithfully. We had called sometimes, but always ever so carefully. Each word had to be calculated for its perceived implication and connotation before written or uttered, lest the letters would be opened and examined, always in fear of a third party eavesdropping on our conversations. We had lost spontaneity over time and distance. Here are my children. She pulled out a packet of pictures. I thumbed through them, trying to find her in each face. It's a shame they couldn't be here, I said. I want them to meet my daughters. I yearned for the second generation to connect, to build bridges the way we had for so many years in Shiraz. Our closeness lasted through high school, college, a revolution, through our years apart. After I left Iran for the U.S., while she remained behind, a part of me was torn away. This is home, she had said when I asked her to leave with me. Go if you must, she added, but this is the only home I have. At the time, I was envious that she felt so firmly bound to Iran, whereas my Judaism made me a nomad like my ancestors, always on shaky grounds, always on alert, looking for other places to settle. Shireh didn't understand my fears. That was the winter of 1979. The country buzzed with the excitement of a revolution in the wind. Shireh told me I was as much an Iranian as she. Still, she would help me leave, even though we were like sisters, even though she wanted to keep me near. Now, 30 years later, I pick her up from Kennedy Airport in New York, planning to spend a few days touring the city before taking her to Virginia and my adopted hometown. My family can't wait to meet you, I tell her, but I am happy to have you just to myself for now. Shireh's visit is my Hanukkah gift. In the lunar Hebrew calendar, my birthday and Hanukkah coincide this year. I am turning 54. 3 times 18, triple chai, 3 times the value of life in Jewish mysticism. The number 3 has special importance as well, a trinity of a sort, denoting a person's relationship to self, to others, and to God. In honor of these 2 special events, my husband and daughters wanted to give me an extra special gift, a small piece of jewelry maybe, a spa in Arizona. I asked them to find out which airlines flew to Iran and where passengers must change airports. There were no longer direct flights from Tehran to New York as there were when I came to America. No, they rallied, horrified. I surely would not want to visit my birthplace after all these years. Not now. What if I didn't make it back? They reminded me that I am Jewish, that I have visited Israel, that I am a writer. Each factor a cause for concern. Any gifts but that, they insisted. What about a holiday in Paris? What about Casablanca as a more exotic location? China? Istanbul looks almost like Iran if I were homesick after all these years. Honestly, I said, what I really want for Hanukkah and for my birthday this year is a round-trip ticket from Tehran to New York, but not for me. I reassured them that although I yearned to revisit my country of birth, I wanted the ticket so I could bring my childhood friend Shora to America, a trip she could not afford. That would be the best Hanukkah gift, the most meaningful birthday present for me. Shora is the friend I played hopscotch with, the friend with whom I skipped school to go to the movies. We saw 2001, which neither one of us understood, but were awed by its exotic nature. We saw an Iranian love story filled with singing and dancing. The poor man married the rich girl in the end. Shora introduced me to the Beatles. We locked the door to her bedroom, stretched ourselves on the Persian carpet, and listened to Yesterday, smoking her cigarettes, a forbidden pleasure. We listened to the Rolling Stones, but also to the deep, throaty voice of the singer Mavash. She introduced me to Farrukha Farrokhzad, the daring Iranian woman who wove her private life into poetry, a feminist statement before I knew the meaning of feminism. Shora and I gossiped about handsome young men at Shiraz University, about our friends and love and marriage. We were cool. We were progressive, we thought. Shora was my bridge between the Western and Iranian cultures and music. I didn't appreciate them as much before meeting her. She was a bridge between my religion and hers. A devout Muslim, she had as much respect for my Judaism as she had for her own beliefs. She showed me that it was possible to straddle modernity and faith. During the month of Ramadan, Shora fasted. We could not stop in at a local cafe for our usual parfait of fresh carrot juice with a floating scoop of vanilla ice cream. But as the muezzin's haunting voice from the mosque's minaret called the Muslim faithful to prayers, I headed to Shara's house to share with her family the traditional sweets. I sat cross-legged around their sofra, the white cloth spread on a tribal carpet. From the delicacies displayed, I chose halva and sticky masgati, sandwiched between two rice cookies. Shora's mother asked me about my wishes before starting her evening prayers, now bending on her knees, now standing with her palms open to receive Allah's benevolence. She added my wishes to hers and her children's. But wasn't there a Jewish holiday to which I could invite Shora to return her generosity? Most of our holidays were filled with lengthy rituals. We had a Seder not just for Passover, but also for Rosh Hashanah, with symbolic foods and prayers, asking God to keep our enemies away, to safeguard us against hostile nations, including the very ones where we were citizens. Maybe it would have been a good idea for her to see where my uncertainty stemmed from, how it was ingrained in me through the observance of each holiday. Instead, I invited her to the Holiday of Lights. I knew about her regular visits to Shah Chiragh, a Muslim holy site in Shiraz, to pray, to light candles. Our religions share that hope of illuminating our souls, symbolically shown through the flickering flames. On the eighth night of Hanukkah, when the lights are the brightest, Shora arrived to celebrate with us. My mother fried carrot and parsnip pancakes, which we ate right off the griddle, sesame oil glistening our lips. Later, we gathered around my father as he lit our homemade oil menorah, a long tube with eight lips for wicks. The kitchen smelled of sesame seed oil in the frying pan and in the menorah. In its light, we recited the prayers. Blessed are you, our God, sovereign of the universe, who performed miracles for our ancestors. Charette said amen with us. This year, in my house in Virginia, surrounded by my husband, my daughters, and my childhood friend, we again light the Hanukkah candles. This time, the prayers apply to Charette and me as well. For is it not a miracle that a Jewish woman and a Muslim woman can keep alive the light of their friendship after so many years? We will add our own personal prayers. Blessed are you, our God, who has kept us alive, sustained us, and enabled us to reach this season.
Susan Stamberg read My Hanukkah Gift by Farida Golden. Golden was born in Iran to a family of Dayanim, judges and leaders of the Jewish community. Her family moved out of a Jewish ghetto to a Muslim neighborhood when she was 8 years old. There, she experienced both friendship and anti-Semitism. She wrote a memoir, Wedding Song, Memoirs of an Iranian Jewish Woman. Hanukkah Lights, readings of the holiday season, read by Susan Stamberg and Murray Horowitz. All of the stories you've just heard were commissioned by NPR and written especially for Hanukkah Lights. Stories from past editions of Hanukkah Lights have been collected in an illustrated book called Hanukkah Lights, Stories of the Season. The book is available at the NPR shop, online at shop.npr.org, or at 1-888-NPR-DISC with a C. To hear this year's stories again, along with stories from previous Hanukkah Lights programs, you can visit npr.org/holidays. Hanukkah Lights was produced by Bruce Scott and Saraya Muhammad. Music was by Jorah Feidman. Thanks for joining us for this year's edition of Hanukkah Lights.